I'm Mark Franklin, practice leader of a team of professional career counselors at CareerCycles.com and founder of One Life Tools. I'm pleased to be your host today on Career Buzz, Canada's unique podcast conversation that enriches lives, empowers careers, and energizes organizations. I am your Career Buzz correspondent, interviewing keynoters, speakers, and delegates at the Canadian Positive Psychology Association's 2018 conference, which was held in Toronto. The CPPA promotes the science and practice of positive psychology and facilitates collaboration amongst researchers, practitioners, teachers, and students in Canada. Today, we hear from three conference speakers. John Helliwell on what can be done to support happier lives globally. Bill Craig, president of the association, on his own unique story and his vision for the CPPA organization. And finally, Jay Gosselin, founder and president of Mentor You, inspiring others to create significance in their lives. Up first, over the past decade, and supported in part by the World Happiness Report, there's growing interest in learning more about what can actually be done to support happier lives globally. John Helliwell tells us how. He's Professor Emeritus in the Vancouver School of Economics at the University of British Columbia. From 2006 to 17, he was also Senior Fellow at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. Recent books of John's include Well-Being for Public Policy, International Differences in Well-Being, and six editions of the World Happiness Report, edited with Jeffrey Sachs. John Helliwell is a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and Officer of the Order of Canada. John was truly the inspiring closing keynote at this year's Canadian Positive Psychology Association conference. Here's my interview with John Helliwell. Welcome, John Helliwell, to Career Buzz.
Nice to be here.
So what are you liking about your career these days, John?
I'm working on something that's a lot of fun to study. And it's important to people, it's important to their lives, and there's room for changes to be made.
Nice. And I said in the intro, you're doing a lot of things. You're a fellow of the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research and at UBC. What are all the things that make up your career these days?
Well, these days, because I'm no longer full-time in the classroom, it's mainly research and writing and speaking around the world, not just in Vancouver.
What would you say are your top few skills or strengths that you draw on and have drawn on to be successful in your career?
Well, I mean, for some decades, I was an empirically oriented economist, and a lot of those skills and habits of being careful with data and imaginative in their use translated very quickly and easily into the study of well-being. So it's possible then to combine a more conventional analysis with more interesting features, which the happiness data provide. So in a sense, I've been liberated over the last couple of decades by moving from a narrow economic focus to having an umbrella measure of the quality of people's lives, and then using that as the objective for our communal and individual efforts, and then using the science to judge the importance of various supports for that, which include the economic and the physical health, and most importantly of all, the quality of the social connections that bind us.
We'll get into that in a moment. Just to come back to your own story, everybody has their twists and turns in their careers and lives. Is there a turning point for you that you could share with listeners in your career that has somehow contributed to you being where you are?
The turn that was most dramatic in terms of changing me from more conventional economics to a strong focus on well-being happened during a few years in the early 1990s when I was in the visiting chair of Canadian Studies at Harvard, and my colleagues included especially Robert Putnam, who was just at that time starting to develop this notion of social capital as a measure of things that are important to our lives. And so I started working with him on these issues, and we started together and separately, getting social capital measured more regularly by national governments around the world. And only about that time, in the search for a broader way of judging the importance of social capital than just looking at its consequences for economic growth, which are obviously only part of the story, did I discover that in fact there were already at that time a fair number of data measuring people's satisfaction with their own lives. And so as soon as I saw that, I said, Eureka, but I didn't know whether in fact I'd discovered something real or something false. So I went back and spent a couple of years as Aristotle's research assistant testing the propositions he had made 2 millennia ago with these modern data, finding out that they supported both Aristotle and the data.
Let's turn our attention now to the report that you've been working on. We're here at the Canadian Positive Psychology Association Conference, and I know you're going to talk to us a little bit about happiness research, but how that translates into happier societies, right? And this is a global, it's a world thing here. What is the problem that we're trying to address when we try and say, let's measure something, let's try and figure something out? What's the problem that we're trying to address?
Well, once you have a measure of the quality of life, then the problem is how do you improve it? And the solutions are dependent, of course, on what you have discovered about what the supports for better lives are.
Now, there are lots of ways of measuring happiness or well-being, and it sounds like you've been experimenting with some. What is something that is consistent, that works across cultures and across languages, that works for this kind of work?
The thing that works best is something that's called a life evaluation. There are several ways of asking the question. The World Happiness Report is based on the results from almost 200 countries from the Cantrell Ladder, which asks people to think of their lives as a ladder, with the best possible life being a 10 and the worst as a 0. How would they rate their lives these days? Another one is used widely in Canada, life satisfaction. Think, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole, from 0 to 10? And finally, in some other surveys, how happy are you with your life as a whole, 0 to 10? A number of other surveys ask things that aren't quite so comparable, and they're usually measures of positive affect, negative affect, or increasingly some of the other things that support better lives, like a life purpose and so on. But the primary measures are these life evaluations.
So we're just talking about different evaluation tools. So John, what do we know about these tools that help us, especially when we think about both positive feelings and emotions versus the absence of negative emotions?
In the field of well-being measurement, and Ed Diener is the person who's led the way on this over the decades, the distinction's made between 3 main types of information. One are life evaluations, another is positive emotions, and a third is negative emotions. And we find that of the 3, as I suggested, the life evaluations are the most powerful and comparable. We also find that positive emotions are a very strong support for life evaluations, even beyond the influence that flows with them through life circumstances, much stronger than is the case for the absence of negative emotions. So that's supporting a basic notion in positive psychology, that the presence of the positives is more important than the absence of the negatives.
So let's come to the results of what you've been finding over the years in the report, and how, you know, here we are in Canada. How did we fare in Canada relative to other nations on evaluating happiness?
Canada it has consistently been in the top 10. In fact, the actual identities of the top 10 are almost unchanged from year to year, although there's a fair amount of shifting around in the ranks. Canada has been as high as 4 and as low as 7 in the 6 editions of the World Happiness Report.
Out of 200 and some odd countries?
The number ranked each year is usually about 155.
155, and so we're in between 4 and 6 or 7.
Yeah. So it's definitely the first league.
Listeners are going to want to know who's in the top 1 or 2 or 3 positions.
Well, the top 5, there have been 4 countries number 1 in 6 reports. Denmark, Finland, Switzerland, and Norway. And very close to that would be Iceland. All those five countries are traditionally the top five, and then the rest of the top 10 is rounded out by a group of countries that include Australia, New Zealand, Sweden, Canada, Netherlands.
Wow. So I want to ask a little bit about why Canada fares the way it does and why people come out on top. But just for contrast, where do our friends in the United States figure in?
In the very first report, United States was 11. It's been falling steadily. It's now number 18. That's attributed mainly not to lack of economic growth, where it has had more or less as much as anyone else, but the decaying of the quality of their social fabric as measured by these variables that we monitor in the Gallup World Poll, including measures of corruption, which is a more restricted notion of the broader importance of trust, a sense of freedom, having someone to count on in times of trouble.
So now we're getting into the, you know, how is this explained? Why is Finland or Iceland or Canada high? Why does the United States drop and those other countries that are closer to the bottom? So I was pretty fascinated to see that you've really started to categorize the reasons why certain countries are going to position themselves in this list of 155 countries. And there's a couple of key reasons. I think the corruption one was one. I was fascinated by the one that you call freedom to make life choices. Just as one example of an explained by, can you explain what that is and how does that work?
We're prisoners of the data we have. The Gallup World Poll wasn't set up to include all the most important variables for explaining well-being. We choose from quite a large menu and have experimented with quite a few. Systematically, we found a strong importance from the simple answer on a 0 to 1 scale, asking 1,000 people per year in each of these countries, do you feel a sense of freedom to make your key life decisions? So we don't know in each social context, each country, exactly what that means, but we know it's important to people to feel that. And what's required to make even, for example, some countries that have been in what other countries would regard as pretty awful circumstances, but life has changed and doors have opened. You find this sense of freedom really jumping. Sometimes, of course, it then falls back later when they realize that what they were hoping for didn't entirely come about.
I don't know if listeners caught what you just said. This is not a 0 to 10 scale. This is a 0 to 1 scale. It's either on or off. Do you or do you not have freedom to make life choices?
So it's the fraction of the people in the country that feel they have that freedom. And, of course, it does change from year to year.
Can you say anything about what Canadians say to that question versus others?
Well, there are six variables we use to explain across these 150 countries. Two of them are standard income per capita and healthy life expectancy. Then the other four are, in some sense, all measuring different aspects of the social fabric. One is corruption, a sort of measure of trust. The other is freedom to make key life decisions. A third one, often ignored, is generosity. To what extent are people, your neighbors and yourself, generous? And lastly, do you have someone to count on in times of trouble? It's very important.
And those questions were all asked, and partly we're seeing countries like Finland and the Scandinavian countries where they are known for their social fabric and social programs and supports different from, say, the United States.
Well, people all say, is this because they're big social safety net countries with high taxes? And I say, well, you got to remember that top five always includes Switzerland, which is a very small government country. The important point is the support is there for people in their communities. That's much more important than whether a particular country decides whether things are best provided at the neighborhood level, or the national level, or in Switzerland, the cantonal level.
Last little area to dig into, John, is what do we know about immigrants' happiness versus those people who were born here in Canada, say?
The most important feature of this year's World Happiness Report was its focus in four or five of its chapters on the happiness of immigrants. And so a key finding was we looked at the happiness across all countries. Now, this is going back over a dozen years to build up sufficient samples of immigrants in each of these countries. We compare the happiness of immigrants with the happiness of the locally born. The astonishing thing is that if you rank countries by the happiness of their immigrants, it's almost identical to the happiness of the locally born in ranking across countries and in level, which is quite remarkable. Because what that then tells you is, because countries draw their immigrants from countries with very different levels of subjective well-being, that there's what we call a convergence process, that immigrants move towards the average life satisfaction of the people in the communities to which they're moving. And it trues about whether you move to city A or city B or country A or country B. We prove that by looking, because we have huge samples of data for the UK as well as Canada, we could look at the happiness of people from 100 different countries coming to Canada. 70 countries, same, and then we had a common set of 70 countries providing immigrants to both Canada and the UK. In both cases, they converged, but they converged to the domestic level, so that the immigrants to the UK from the same countries have happiness levels that differ from people from the same country moving to Canada by about 0.3 points on the 10-point scale, which is exactly the difference between the happiness levels of the locally born. So this gives you, shows you the power of the milieu in which you live to determine what you think about your life.
Wow, so that's a pretty fascinating finding.
So much for the set point theory in psychology, right?
Well, it's a set point of a whole country.
Well, there is no set point. I mean, the set point psychologists say these people were born with it, and the international differences are due to personality differences, but that clearly isn't the case.
And that's coming from countries, as we know, people come to Canada from all these different countries. I looked, I think in one of your slides, you show the top few countries, but then you show the bottom few countries who, you know, are significantly lower on their happiness and well-being. And those numbers, maybe you can describe for listeners how different they are, and that would make it all the more powerful for explaining that immigrant experience who might shoot up from a low score all of a sudden to a higher score.
Or shoot down, because, of course, some people are migrating to some very unhappy countries as well as some happy countries. They tend to migrate towards happier countries. There is also a footprint effect, as we call it, whereby some of your happiness is based on the happiness where you were born. We figure it's about 10%. So it means that because people in the happiest countries are coming from unhappier countries, the average immigrant happiness is a little less than the locally born in the happiest countries. It's more than the locally born in the least happy countries. And on the world average, it's essentially identical.
Fascinating. It's
very powerful.
You know, and listeners to this podcast and radio show are going to start to think about that from their own perspectives and which countries they came from. If they are interested in finding the report and where their country of origin ranked, how do they do that?
World Happiness Report. Go to that site. You can download each of the six reports, but even better, you could download all the data that underlie it.
So, John, we seem to collect a lot of data here in Canada on this particular topic. Is there anything that you're finding about what we can learn and how that's beneficial if we collect more data?
Well, as we noted before, the detailed discussion of immigrants from different countries and their happiness was possible in Canada and the UK only because the statistical agencies include these key questions in their main social and health surveys. Further than that, we've got almost 500,000 responses in Canada over the last few years. So we were able to define the geography of Canada into 1,200 communities, rural and components of big cities, each of which corresponds to a genuine neighborhood with the boundaries we have for neighborhoods.
So even in Toronto, for instance, where many people are listening, we would have distinct neighborhoods that we could look at and find?
Many neighborhoods in probably 100 to 200 neighborhoods of the 1,200 are actually in Toronto.
Great. So what did we learn?
What we've learned is, and the data have been made available, they could be got off my UBC website, so you can find out not only the paper describing the method, but the actual data for all the neighborhoods in Canada. Furthermore, it's all linked to census data, so you know what's true about the census characteristics of these neighborhoods. And we look at the top happiest fifth of the neighborhoods in the country and compare them to the bottom. no effect of income, no effect of unemployment. A sense of community belonging is the biggest thing that distinguishes the top fifth from the bottom fifth. It's quite extraordinary, and this is true whether you look among urban communities, and it's a big variation among neighborhoods within cities, and also whether you look country, rural versus cities, a really significant gap between city-level happiness and rural happiness. And people then say, does that mean we should all be moving to these rural areas? And I say the same thing that we said in the context of immigration. No, that's the wrong answer. For a mixture of reasons, the urbanization movement is not going to reverse itself. But what you have to learn is the secrets of better, happier lives in rural areas and reconstruct them in your neighborhoods at home. Another way of putting it is, act in the streets as though you were a driver in Halifax or St. John's and not a driver on Bay Street.
Right on. And anything you can tell us about where those top fifth and bottom fifth are for contrast?
Yeah, the top fifth are predominantly in rural areas and in the less crowded parts and friendlier parts of the metropolitan areas, and the bottom fifth are mainly in big cities.
Fascinating results. We're looking forward to finding out more, John. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Gee, wasn't that just remarkable? John Helliwell, Order of Canada, focusing on the World Happiness Report and others. It was so interesting to hear him. We were sitting outside. You heard some wind and some sounds there outside the conference center at Victoria University within the University of Toronto. One thing to flag, I mean, it was just so interesting, and I don't know if you caught it. The most important finding, John said, was about the happiness of immigrants, and that when people immigrate from all these different countries, whatever their level of happiness or well-being, it tends to converge to the average of that country. So if people come to Canada, which typically ranks in the top five, and they come from countries that might be in the middle or the bottom half out of 200 plus countries, people's happiness converges to the locale. And so he makes the argument that happiness and well-being is socially constructed. We make it. We do it. He said he doesn't have to go to Denmark. He says he needs to take a little bit of Denmark and bring it back to Canada. And that's how he lives his life and how he's changed over the past 30 years. So a really great interview. Thanks so much, John Helliwell, for giving us that Career Buzz interview. Up after the break, we're going to hear from two more people at the conference. We have Bill Craig, president and board chair of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association, coming up, and Jay Gosselin, who is founder of Mentor You. Stay with us.
I'm Mark Franklin, and you're listening to the Career Buzz podcast. Career Buzz is brought to you by Career Cycles. Take inspired action toward making well-informed career and life choices. Go to careercycles.com to learn about professional one-on-one career management programs using a story listening approach to career counseling. If you're a helping professional looking to scale up career management, visit onelifetools.com to learn about the Who You Are Matters game and online storyteller.
Bill Craig is president and board chair of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association. He is passionate about strengthening well-being literacy. Love that term, well-being literacy, and developing well-being policies and strategies to support human thriving. For the past 6 years, Bill's been actively involved in the broad-based, multidisciplinary assessment of well-being, happiness, and quality of life at several levels, in the community, in business, municipal, and regional levels. His specialty, how to use well-being assessment to bring about whole system changes in policies, programs, and services. Here is my interview with Bill Craig.
Welcome, Bill Craig, to Career Buzz.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What are you liking about your career these days?
Well, my career, you know, I've had a pretty diverse career over my life, but what I decided to do when I I turned about 50 was to focus more on well-being, quality of life, and happiness. And I've been able to actually move forward in that a little bit more quickly than I thought. And learning more about positive psychology, which is really the area that sort of focuses on, that is really the science behind well-being, quality of life, and happiness. Really understanding what well-being is, happiness is, what quality of life is, how to actually measure it. And then once you measure it, how to actually use that information to improve your happiness, quality of life, and well-being, whether you're an individual, whether you're a business, or whether you're a company, or whether you're a city or town, or whether you're a region, or even from a country point of view. And I've had the opportunity to work from a global perspective as well in that area.
Nice. So you're now leading the Canadian Positive Psychology Association. What are all the different hats that you wear now in your career?
Well, in my career, I there's the leading of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association, and really that's promoting Canadian well-being. It's promoting a positive psychology. It's taking it a step further from just researchers and practitioners, but really to just the average Joe, the typical Canadian on the street. What are the tools that you need to move forward? So I'm focusing on that. I also have a separate business that I've focuses on the merging positive psychology with organizations and organizational design, and that focuses on a positive culture within an organization, positive leadership. It focuses on positive teams and teaming, positive workplace, positive innovation.
Nice. And what would you say is one turning point in your career? You didn't start by leading the charge in the well-being and positive psychology world, so you've had quite an interesting career story. What's a turning point for you?
Well, probably for me, the turning point was, I've had several, I've been a sort of a serial entrepreneur, and I've had several businesses over the years, and I, a business person, you're chasing the next piece of work and the next contract, and what I've done, probably around 50 years old, I sort of went, okay, there's got to be something a little more to life, and so what was the meaning of life for me? That and it really came down to, I thought about it, and it came down to really the relationships that you have, the experiences that you have in life, and then having a little bit more meaning and purpose. And once I sort of figured that out, and at the time I started a new business which measures well-being, quality of life, and happiness for communities, for cities, for provinces and states, and for the nation, for Canada, and also for other countries as well. And so I was getting into that, and it just gelled with my view of the meaning of life, which was relationships and experiences. So I was able to move forward on that and work in that area. And then I got into what was the science behind well-being and quality of life and happiness. And it's really positive psychology and the areas of positive psychology, which are around positive emotion, engagement, relationships, meaning and achievement, and just vitality. So if you just focus on the vitality piece of positive psychology, it's incredible value as an individual, and then it progresses more to the community side and the region side as well.
Nice. Yeah. My guest today is Bill Craig. He's president of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz. So, Bill, let's talk a little bit about your role now in the association. And I know it's trying to achieve so many things with this new science of positive psychology, just to pick up on the thread that you were just talking about, well-being, right? And spreading well-being across Canada and the challenge or the gaps of where people are at now and where we'd like to see them. How can you nudge that along?
Well, we're sitting outside of this beautiful facility here, and we have a conference, and the conference theme is Bridging Canadian Well-Being. And this is the first step of sort of a vision or strategy to sort of move that along. And there's several gaps that we need to focus on, and I don't want to get into all the gory details of those gaps, but it's really the relationship between researchers and practitioners, and between practitioners and just the Canadian Canadians, the general public, and then also the relationship of how can government play in that relationship as well. So all of those need to fit together. They need to be in sync, and that's part of the gap right now, is they're not in sync. So that's where I see a huge opportunity for the Canadian Positive Psychology Association, is to help enable all of those to be in sync and get government developing policies and strategies that can promote Canadian well-being, but also not just at each government level, how those government levels integrated together so that we're all working together. And we part of that is developing a shared vision for well-being for Canadians. And we need to have government, business, researchers, practitioners, academia, all working together to bring that shared vision, to identify the shared vision, and then make it so. So that's one area. Another area is just, what is well-being for people? It's there's so many definitions of well-being, quality of life, happiness, and that, and they don't actually all agree as well. But for the average, the average person, what is well-being? What does a life of well-being look like? And so no one's really defined that yet. And we've got all kinds of individual contributions, but we don't have a picture of that. And then once we have that picture, then you can sort of be strategic about how do you actually get from our current state to our future state. What are the things that we need to introduce at the various levels of government, and how do we introduce things to individuals and to communities? So those are the sort of the key areas that I'm focusing on, and probably the other areas around right now. Positive psychology is really focused on individuals, so I want to sort of take that out a little bit and go from positive psychology focusing on individuals to more groups and teams and communities and cities, and eventually to Canada itself.
Wow. Okay, so there's lots to follow up on from what you just said there. There are big things. Just taking it to the average Canadian and this idea of what is well-being, and I know you've used this term well-being literacy. So can we just talk a bit about that? What would that mean? What does the term mean? And then what does it mean to the average Canadian?
Yeah. Well, for the average Canadian, I mean, you can keep it as simple as what's the good life, and is it there's all kinds of technical terms for describing well-being, and without getting into any of those, how do you live a good life? What are the techniques that you can use to sort of improve your life, and not just your own life, but also focus on your family's life and your community life, all of that. So there's lots of interventions that or techniques. We use the word interventions, but there's just lots of techniques that you can use to move forward on a good life and to be happier. And whether that means certain activities, or you want to have a more meaningful life, all of those things. So if you, from a positive psychology point of view, to the everyday person, there's a great acronym that's used, which is PERMA-V, and I mentioned that earlier, but it's really around focusing on positive emotions and having more positive than negative emotions, being more engaged and being in flow in your life and in work, having more relationship, higher quality relationships as well, or deeper relationships. That's another area. Having more meaning and purpose in your life, and people. The last one is achievement, or second last one is achievement, which is really goal setting and how do you get things done, and you feel good when you get things done. And then the last one is vitality, which is more around fitness, health, nutrition, meditation, things like that.
So you've just given us the PERMA V there. I don't know if listeners caught it right. So we had the P for positive emotions, E for engagement, R for relationships, M for
meaning and purpose,
A for achievement, and then the V is at the end there for vitality.
Yes,
right. Correct. So if listeners are just trying to tune into what positive psychology is all about and how that might turn into kind of a well-being literacy, it sounds like what you're promoting is a way to increase the quality of the conversation around this topic that people don't necessarily talk about. So how do we achieve that?
Yeah, well, it's like any in any field that you're in developing literacy, it becomes around awareness. First of all, where is there information around positive psychology and PERMA-V, as I described? It comes around learning it. So there's one of the areas in positive psychology around learning is to make it fun. We use the word edutainment, but making it fun so you do learn, and then eventually when you learn, you start to know the aspects of PERMA-V, and then you start to apply it to your life, and then you start to help others to apply it into their lives.
My guest today is Bill Craig. He's the president of the Canadian Positive Psychology Association. I'm your host, Mark Franklin. So, Bill, you know, you're the leader of the organization with an interesting background. Here we are at the conference. There are many researchers and faculty and practitioners. You come at it from a business background and business experience. You know, and you shared earlier a little bit about the need for things like advocacy at the government level, at the business level. So what might you be able to bring, the skills and experiences from that perspective, that might be a kind of a fresh take on this whole need to build well-being literacy and to advocate on the, all these different levels?
Well, you know, I think the fresh take for me is the big picture. It's involving all you know, we use the word stakeholders, but involving everybody in this shared vision for well-being for Canada, and focusing, like I said earlier, on individual Canadians, you know, all the other stakeholders I mentioned, which are, you know, researchers, practitioners, academia, all the levels of government, but getting a shared vision for Canadian well-being, getting them all focused on that shared vision. And we're not developing individual shared visions for all of those groups. It needs to be one shared vision on Canadian well-being that we can move forward on, and then using the CPPA as you know, one of the mechanisms for helping bring that about, but hopefully partnering with business and government and academia and individual Canadians. You know, it'd be lovely to have a sort of a Canadian, you know, a group of Canadians contribute to what Canadian well-being is. My ultimate goal in the near future is to create a Canadian well-being strategy and policy that we can all sort of align to and work together on to actually bring about true Canadian well-being.
So people should stay tuned to the website to mm-hmm. see that emerge. If people do want to find out more about the organization, how do they do that?
Yeah, they can easily go to the Canadian Positive Psychology Association website, which is cppa.ca, and you can navigate through there and find additional information as we get going on this initiative. I think we might actually sort of push this initiative forward under a banner of Canadian well-being or Flourishing Canada or something like that.
Great. Last question, Bill. You started off telling us a little bit about your own career and some of the twists and turns that brought you into this field. What's one thing you can share with listeners about that you've learned about making good career and life choices that you can share with listeners?
Well, I'm a big believer in diversity and not doing the same thing all the time. And my number one key character strength is love of learning. So it's that maybe a little bit easier for me to do. But the one thing that I could probably recommend to everybody is just that initial awareness of the concepts and the tools that are available to improve individual well-being, quality of life, and happiness. There's all kinds of information out there and techniques that you can use that are available to anyone right now. And it's all based on lots of research that supports those activities. And it's there. And that's, for me, when I found that information, that really allowed me to move forward. And you know, I've not really been at this for long. It's been 6 or 7 years. So, you know, it's allowed me to really get into the field, and it's allowed me to create value and make an impact on whatever the context is, whether it's my individual life, my family, my community, or the city, or the province, or the country.
Lovely, Bill Craig. Thanks so much for joining us here on Career Buzz.
Thank you very much, Mark.
That was my interview with Bill Craig from the Canadian Positive Psychology Association's 2018 conference. Next up, we had one of the delegates to the conference, Jay Goslin. Uninspired by the career prospects after studying economics, Jay Goslin decided to take to the open seas, where he worked as a cruise director. Next, in 2007, he worked on the Olympic Games, and then a job at the University of Ottawa in recruitment and a master's degree in counseling. Now, Jay Goslin runs Mentor You. He believes your 20s are for building your experience, your 30s are for building your expertise, and your 40s and 50s are building your dreams. Here's my interview with Jay Goslin.
Jay Goslin, welcome to Career Buzz.
Hi, Mark. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
What do you like about your career these days?
I like a lot of things, but I would say that what I love the most is that I have the freedom and flexibility to do things that are meaningful to me, and I get to craft the entirety, really, of my business, along with collaboration from many talented people. And but what I love the most is that I get to help people fulfill their potential in a variety of different ways.
So what is that variety? I know you wear a number of hats. You do a bunch of different things. The Discovery Year is one thing we'll talk about. But what are all the things that make up your life and career these days?
So I like to say that I'm a career and leadership development coach. So that involves I do a lot of team building activities. So the way I make my living really is with corporate groups mostly. So I do team building, communications, and leadership development and training. And I do some one-on-one coaching in the career and leadership realm as well. And I spend a lot of my time on the Discovery Year, which you mentioned, which is a semi-structured, purposeful gap year for young adults between the ages of 18 and 22.
Nice. What would you say the top two or three skills, aptitudes that you draw on to be successful in all these different careers that you have?
I'd say my social intelligence, which comes out as my character strengths, my number one strength in the VIA Character Strengths Survey. That's something I draw on all the time. I've recruited well over 100 now volunteers to be part of the Discovery Year, which is thanks to, number one, my passion about the project for it, and my love of community and my ability to communicate that in an effective way to others that helps them become inspired by themselves through the eyes of the program.
Nice. So many people in this space, coaching and counseling, come at it from a zigzagging career path. What's one turning point that you could share with listeners in your career story that has eventually brought you to the present moment?
Yeah, really hard to nail it down to one, but if I had to choose one, it was meeting 12,000 students over a period of about 6 years at the University of Ottawa, where I worked as a liaison officer. So I promoted this school to and various programs to students, and I met tons of parents, educators along the way, and the only way I can define my relationship with those conversations was heartbreak. And students would repeatedly come up and I would ask them, I started by asking them what they wanted to study in university, and I quickly realized that that was absolutely the wrong answer, because they would go through the Rolodex of programs that they thought were interesting and important to others, and rather than tell me about what they wanted for themselves. And so I tweaked that question and asked them what got them out of bed in the morning, what they spent their time doing on the weekends, what they loved. And they told me all these fantastic things that were exciting, and they were enthusiastic and curious. And then I would ask them what they wanted to study, and they would tell me, oh, you know, I'm going to go into engineering because that's how you make a living, or, you know, there's jobs in technology. That's the way of the future. I need to do that. Even though they just told me how they loved creating positive relationships with others, or they loved studying cultures or doing artwork. And then they told me, and the energy would be drained from their bodies when they told me they wanted to do medicine or accounting or law or engineering, because that's what everyone around them told them was the only way to have a positive, successful career. So that really helped me understand that a different type of program was needed for students to help them transition. So the slogan for my company, Mentor You, is strive for significance. And I loved it when I first heard that, strive for significance rather than material success. So I felt that there was another avenue needed to help people do that.
Nice. Thanks for sharing that story. My guest today is Jay Gosselin. He's founder and president of Discovery Year. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz. So, Jay, we're here at the Canadian Positive Psychology Association Conference. You and I just met here, and I know there's so many crossovers between strengths and positive psychology and the notion of Discovery Year. So let's get into that. But first, you told us a bit about, I guess, the origin of Discovery. You're talking to 12,000 students and their parents and all of that. So in a nutshell, what is it and why, what problem does it solve? Why does it exist?
So it exists because I met these 12,000 students, and then not only in high school but on campus as well, where I worked in the co-op program, the cooperative education program, and I helped students find jobs and employers. And I heard a couple things. Number one, I heard that students were not there for the right reasons, and then I started reading all the literature and hearing from many others about the mental health crisis across campuses in North America and elsewhere, to the tune where 46% of students have one major depressive episode at least within the last year, and the overwhelming majority are anxious on a day-to-day basis. So I had all those experiences, and it made me realize that students are not going into post-secondary in a purposeful manner to a significant extent. So what we did is we created a program that I think melded or offered a strategy for students to not only find out what's most important to them and what they're best at, but also to help them understand how they could use that to help the world around them. And so the Discover Year is a full year program. They do work for about 10 months of the year. They find their own jobs. We help them understand how to effectively do so, and we coach them through that process. They work about 10 months. They travel for 4 to 6 weeks, the month of February. They go anywhere in the world that they want to go. It's up to them to decide what their budget is, what's interesting, what part of the world they want to explore. Again, we help coach them through the process of maybe it's the first time they're traveling on their own or to a foreign land. So, but it's up to them to inspire their own intrinsic motivations and to pursue those things in a meaningful way. They have a community service project that they develop, plan, and implement on their own in small teams throughout the year to help them understand the emotional and psychological benefits of contributing to the community around them in a meaningful way. And we meet every week. They also have a career coach that they work with once a month, but every week throughout the working terms, we meet as a group and we help them build the most important skills that all these hundreds of employers told me are so important yet often lacking in not only recent graduates but across the workforce, but in particular the young workforce, and things like oral communication, written communication, problem solving, giving and receiving feedback, intercultural communication, time management, initiative, professionalism. So we work on all those things. Once every week, we have all these different workshops. We have over 100 mentors. A couple of them visit us every week. They're amazing people who do all kinds of a huge diversity of careers and experiences, and they tell us all about the character that they developed and the reasons why they chose the path that they did, how they screwed up and how they recovered, and what they love about the work, what's required in terms of skills. So I found that students could name maybe 10 or 15 professions at best when they left high school, those that I worked with. And so we expose them to those people that do all kinds of careers they don't even know are a thing. And so they really open their minds to all the possibilities.
That's great. We even have an occupational classification in this country that people don't know about. There are over 30,000 job titles in there.
Yeah.
And most people can name, like you say, a dozen or two, right?
Yeah.
So it sounds pretty fascinating. That just let's connect the dots between this positive psychology conference where we are and the program. You mentioned things like employability skills, like communication and critical thinking. What's the crossover between the science of positive psychology and what you're trying to achieve with this Discover Year?
So I guess the light bulb moment for me and my attraction to positive psychology came when I was completing a master's in counseling psychology at the time. In one of my courses, I happened upon Martin Seligman, who's one of the founders of positive psychology. And I heard him speak a lot about character, and character is something that had been ingrained in me. And I think it's one of the things that enabled me to achieve the things that I have in my life. So that was really important for me to understand that. And I think that that's often the missing key, that complementarity of different character strengths, that when I hear employers and others in our society talk about what's lacking, not only in young people, but in general, it often always comes back for me to character. And those that I think of who have had the most true and authentic success that I know or I've read about, they have excellent foundations of character, and they define that in different ways. But so that was really interesting to me, and I loved the concept that I realized early on in my training as in counseling that I wasn't meant to work in pathology. I was meant to work with average, everyday people and help them meet their potential. I don't think I was built to deal with addiction and serious mental distress. So and it has proven to be a very successful method for us to help young people. You know, our methodology is teach a person to fish, like any good career coach or counselor, and really give them the tools to be successful down the road. And I think that those character-driven tools are the most essential.
My guest today is Jay Gosselin. He is founder and president of Discover Year. I'm your host, Mark Franklin, here on Career Buzz. So Jay, this sounds like something that I think many people have heard of called a gap year. And that's something I know that's much more common in places like the United Kingdom. It hasn't quite caught on as far as I see in Canada and the US. And I think there are a lot of reasons why people maybe think it's good for somebody else, but they don't do it themselves. So let's bust some myths here. What are some reasons why people say, no, Jay, I'm not going to do that Discover Year? And what are some rationale? How do you come back to those objections?
Yeah, so the three most common irrational beliefs that people tell me or give me for not wanting to do a gap year. Two come from parents and one comes from students. And it's an interesting conversation because when I meet parents and students, 50% of the time I'm trying to help the parent understand the benefits. 50% of the time I'm trying to help the student. So the parents tell me two things principally. Number one, they say, my kid doesn't go now, they're never going to go. They're going to start working, they're going to love the feel of the dollar bills and the lifestyle that that brings, and they're never going to want to go back. And the evidence shows repeatedly over and over and over time again, students who take that time to work and understand what minimum wage looks like, what living at that wage looks like, that's absolutely an additional motivator for them to go back to school once they figure out what it is that they want to do.
So that one, you actually have to help a young person discover their dislikes.
That's
right? If they don't know it, they need to understand that disliking a minimum wage job might be a strong motivator. And if they haven't had the experience, they just really wouldn't know that.
They really don't understand it. Yeah.
It's not theory. It's actually practice. You need to live that to know it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So they and they see what that looks like. And it gives them, it also helps them develop empathy, which is a big part of our program, and helping students understand what that means and how to practice it effectively. So the second objection that I get from parents is that my son or daughter will lose all their study habits. They'll forget how to learn. They won't be able to do it. So the line of thought I give around that is that one of our mentors, actually, she dropped out of high school. She, you know, many years later has now completed a PhD in psychology, and I use her as a case study because when she was in high school, she just wasn't in the right place. She wasn't interested. Did not mean that she was not an intelligent, curious, passionate person. She absolutely is if you met her today. She just wasn't in the right environment, didn't have the right set of circumstances at the time. And when people are excited and passionate about learning, that far supersedes, it's to a significant degree more important than, you know, reciting the periodic table of elements, as it were, or remembering how to formulate an essay. So, but people are really stuck in these irrational beliefs, and it's they're really in a rut, and oftentimes parents think it's a great idea, but not for their kid. And oftentimes, in fact, the students...
Is that the third one? Because you said there was two. So we've got two, and the study habits, I'm going to forget how to study. So we've now blown that myth out of the water. So what's the last one?
The last one is from students, in fact. So those are the two that I hear most often from parents. But then sometimes the parents come to me and they say, tell me how to convince my kid, because this is what my kid says. And they tell me as well. The kid says, if I don't go now, if I take a year off, I'll be a year behind. And the question, of course, always to them, which they never have an answer for, is a year behind what, right? And it's simply the year, a year behind the status quo. And they've been enforced since the age, since the age of five, we've given them direction down the linear path of elementary, high school, post-secondary. Maybe now they're thinking about masters and PhDs when they're 8 years old. Like, so they've been thinking about this for so long, and to help them derail from that process is challenging because they're at a developmental age where they want to be in similar situations. They want to prove themselves to their friends and society. So, but the reality is that anybody who's ever done a purposeful gap year will absolutely tell you two things I like to say. Number one, a year seems like a long time now, but it's actually just a drop in the bucket. And number two, my gap year was without a doubt one of the most meaningful things I ever did in my life, and enabled me to build the confidence, resourcefulness, and self-awareness to actually do the things that bring me great joy in my life and are meaningful.
Nice. If we just circle back, Jay, we've talked a bit about Discover Year and the things that you're doing. Based on your twists and turns in your own career and your experiences, what's one thing you can share with listeners about what you've learned, about making good life choices, about taking into account things? What's one maybe insight or personal experience you can share with listeners?
So I found it from my own experience and the things that I've read over the years, I think the fundamental mindset that's required to live a significant life has three components: action, openness, and authenticity. And that's the recipe that I use with all my clients and teams that I work with. Action, meaning, like you said, you need to learn these things on your own sometimes. It's not good enough to sit on the couch and think about what you might like or dislike. You need to get out there, push yourself outside of the comfort zone. As we all know, that's where things are learned. It's also the most difficult place to get to. So you got to take action. Try a lot of different things. And that's, I think, underestimated in our society. Openness to the degree where you really need to consider new opportunities and different perspectives perspectives as you're going through this process so that you're not missing out on opportunities that you didn't even know existed. And it's also, the other side is also embracing diversity in those around you. And all the literature and research has shown over and over the magnitude to which people's success is heightened and their fulfillment and their satisfaction in life by diversifying the relationships that they hold. And the third is authenticity, in the sense that it's important to first understand, figure out what your true interests, values, and strengths are, and to utilize those to the best of your abilities to offer meaningful experiences and to help others around you.
Great advice. If people want to find out more, Jay, how do they do that?
You can go to discoveryear.ca, and the company is MentorU, which DiscoverYear operates under. So the website is the best place to start. They can also email me if they'd like to have a chat. It's j@mentoru.ca.
And we'll have a link to that in our podcast write-up that you can find at careercycles.com. Jay Gosselin, thanks so much for joining us here today on Career Buzz.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thank you for listening to the Career Buzz podcast. Find us on iTunes or visit careercycles.com/radio to subscribe and download past episodes. Get inspiring career stories full of twists and turns, actionable ideas from career experts, and new ideas to empower your own career in life.